The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings.
Our differences worldwide would vanish if we were facing an alien threat from outside this world. And yet, I ask you, is not an alien force already among us?
Exopolitics, paranormal phenomena, and deep analysis of current world events from somewhere in the desert between Area 51 and Roswell, blasting across the planet, the Manticore Network proudly presents Veritas, because the truth will set you free.
Headline edition, July 8, 1947. The Army Air Forces has announced that a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army.
It was too fast to be an airplane.
I think it's time to open the books on the question of government investigations of UFOs. We ought to do it really because it's right. We ought to do it because the American people, quite frankly, can handle the truth. And we ought to do it because it's the law.
Be skeptical. Do be as skeptical as you want, but by all, don't close your mind.
Greetings to everyone around the world, and a warm welcome to another edition of the Veritas Show, where we bring you disclosure, one guest at a time. I'm your host, Mal Fabregas, and I sincerely thank you for joining me once again. This is episode number 34. Ever since Veritas was born, I found it very hard to separate conspiracies from the main topic of UFOs. In reality, they are interconnected. I've said that before. However, you will not hear the term conspiracy that often on this show. Conspiracy is the term the powers that be want you to use. From flying saucers, the intelligence apparatus was clever to introduce the term unidentified flying objects, which creates confusion and ridicule. That is why on this show, instead of saying conspiracies, we prefer to use the term parapolitics or parapolitical research. I know there are many of you who write to me and are interested in knowing more about the iron fist behind the invisible hand of politics. This show is for you. In a few minutes, you will hear a brave man who has researched parapolitics for a lifetime. We will discuss some of his books, including The Unseen Hand, The New World Order, and others. Traditionally, I like to keep our shows within 2 hours, but I also like to keep my promise to you that if the material warrants it and the guest agrees on staying, we will add an additional segment. Tonight's 3-hour show is an example of just that. We will break at the end of the first hour and will continue the next 2 hours, again, without any commercial interruptions. We are going to jump right ahead with our special guest, A. Ralph Epperson, but first, since this is our very first solid parapolitics show, I want to give some background to those of you who are not familiar with the term. The term parapolitics was first conceived and elaborated by Professor Raghavan Iyer of Oxford University in his work Parapolitics Toward the City of Man. Also, Peter Dale Scott describes parapolitics as, quote, all those political practices and arrangements, deliberate or not, which are usually repressed rather than acknowledged, unquote. The term is used to describe either covert political activity that is hidden from the public or a complete de facto political system, typically comprising elements of the military and intelligence apparatus, hidden from the public. Political actions of subterfuge, secrecy, and deceit, and is increasingly used in discussions on democracy to describe coalitions of institutions and corporations who operate above or outside of the elected government. The topic would cover subjects such as assassinations, covert actions, the CIA and drugs, MKUltra, BCCI, 9/11, and electoral theft. In other words, subjects sniffed at by debunkers as quote-unquote tinfoil hat stuff. If you need to get in touch with me with questions or feedback, send me an email to mail, that's M-E-L, at veritasshow.com, or stop by the Manticore Forum and join the discussion. By the way, this week's Veritas Show Forum discussion is, what is your favorite conspiracy and why? I also want to let some of you who would prefer to download shows a la carte know that I'm working on a system that will allow just that. Of course, the membership is significantly discounted, but if you still want to download specific shows, I will provide that option to you soon. And now, get ready to examine nearly every aspect of the New World Order conspiracy, from forms of government to science, from Laetrile to the atomic bomb, and everything in between, such as secret societies, the Federal Reserve, population control, income taxes, the Civil War, the Kennedy assassination, the Vietnam War, the erosion of our constitutional rights, and much more. The conspiracy is not a theory. This is Mel Fabregas, and you're listening to The Veritas Show. Don't go anywhere.
Listening to the Veritas Show.
And our guest today is Ralph Epperson, who has studied the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States of America for many years and has discovered what he calls the fatal flaw inside the document. He believes that the information is not known to the American people and that he has decided to do all he can to make it public. He also believes that once the American people understand this, what is happening in this nation will make sense. So may I ask that you, listener, see if you can find a copy of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution so that you can read along with us while I'm telling you a little about our guest. That's okay. Stop the program now if you wish. Google or find these documents and then click on play. We'll be here. Mr. A. Ralph Epperson, welcome to the Veritas Show. How are you?
Well, you're very kind to invite me. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. May I call you Ralph?
Oh, by all means, please do. If you'll allow
me
to call you Mel.
Absolutely, absolutely. If anybody calls me Mr. Fabregas, I'll look behind me to see if I can find my father or my grandfather. In any event, the saying 6 degrees of separation seems to be so appropriate, Ralph. A few days ago, I had a friend of yours, G. Edward Griffin, on the show, and one of our loyal listeners all the way from Greece said, Mel, if you had Edward Griffin on, you must look into Ralph Epperson. And Ralph, that's how most of the guests on this show come along. Someone out there, anywhere around the world, helps me connect the dots, and my job is to make it happen.
I'm very pleased. I don't believe I've ever talked to anybody in Greece, but someone must know, maybe because of they've read a copy of my book, The Unseen Hand, quite possibly.
Exactly. That and a lot of the other material. You also were friends with the late Bill Cooper, Ralph, and many of us listened to your interviews with him. I didn't know Bill had a publication called Veritas, and how coincidental that our show is called Veritas. But to start the show, Let me borrow some words from the late Bill Cooper as he started his interview with you during his radio program, Hour of the Time. Quote, Ralph, give us some background. Who are you? Where do you come from? How did you get into this? What are you doing on this show? How did you get from point A, which is in complete, utter disbelief that anything like this could ever be real, to now, marching out here on the battlefield with others who have found that this is not only real, but it's imminent? Those are words from Bill Cooper. Also, what was the moment or what material did you study that made you open your eyes, your paradigm shift, Ralph?
Well, yeah, I went to the University of Arizona here in Tucson, and after I graduated, I went to California for my first job. And I joined the Young Republicans, and I met a young man named Jim who asked me why I was there. And I said, because I'm from Arizona, I don't know anything about California. He said, no, you're here to read revisionist history. And I said, I've never heard that. He said, that's my point. So he asked me to read. I started. It took me probably three books to figure out there was something going on in this country. And I got very, very concerned because I saw it. And I said, how come I was not taught this at the University of Arizona? So I started reading back in 1963. And I haven't stopped since. I'm still reading, although it's not quite as busy because I've read over 1,100 titles now. And I just, as it's like crawling up a ladder. The more you crawl up the ladder, the more there is to see. And you're constantly being exposed to new material that furthers your education. And that's the way it's been. I've been doing that for 40-some years.
So the closer you are to the trees, the less you can see. But the more removed you are from it, then you can see the forest.
Exactly correct. In fact, I'm quite convinced that there's something really big going on in this country, and I'm very frightened for their future.
Your book, The Unseen Hand, was published back in 1985, and a lot of the material that you state on that book has come to fruition, has come to happen, and things continue to happen.
Yeah, I didn't know that when I wrote it in 1985, because I knew probably about 50% of what I know today. And I'd probably rewrite, if I were to rewrite the book, I'd probably add at least that and maybe take some things out. Because this country is getting worse. We're going someplace, and I know what it is, and I know why we're going there. And I'm trying to do my part to get people educated so they can prevent it. We've got to stop what's going on in this country.
Ralph, when I went to your website, my first impression for the first time, ralph-epperson.com, the first image that jumped at me was a copy of the front page of the Hawaiian newspaper Hilo Tribune. It's from November the 30th, 1941. That's a week before Pearl Harbor, the attack happened. The headline reads, Japan may strike over weekend. Now, how could this newspaper know in advance, but President Roosevelt did not know?
That's the question that I've been asking since I discovered this, although even in The Unseen Hand in 1985, in fact, all the way back to 1973 when I was teaching at a community college in Oregon, I was covering the fact that we knew about the attack on Pearl Harbor. In fact, Roosevelt sat in the White House waiting for notification because we had broken their naval code. We knew they were going to attack, and yet he did nothing. And this here, 9 congressional investigations were conducted after the Hawaii attack at Pearl Harbor, and all 9 of them said Roosevelt did not know. And yet here's a newspaper that says they knew the week before. This was a Sunday newspaper. The attack happened the next Sunday, December 7th, 1941.
One could reasonably conclude that President Roosevelt's intelligence sources were better than the newspaper. But many people say that the fact that Roosevelt knew and let it happen was so that the American people would finally get behind the war effort and that this was just a conspiracy theory. But here you are with a newspaper showing this.
Yes, I know. In fact, our government planned World War II with others from England and primarily Winston Churchill of England and the English government. Back in 1920, and the plan was to create a United Nations after the war was over, and the reason they were going to use was the fact that they were trying to convince us that nations cause wars, and if we can abolish nationalism with the world government, we can abolish war. Remember, World War I was fought to be the war that ended all wars, and yet it wasn't, because the Treaty of Versailles was not approved, so they planned World War II, and World War II killed 53 million people, and that's okay because we had to have the United Nations. That's the thinking of these people like Franklin Roosevelt.
After World War I, didn't we become an isolationist country? We just, if anybody had conflicts, we would let them do it, just like Ron Paul says these days. Let them deal with their own issues, and we're just protect our borders here. What happened? What was the moment that made Roosevelt, I'm sure that he had influence to make him change that posture?
Well, it wasn't him. It was Woodrow Wilson. George Washington, in his farewell address, warned America by something to the effect that we should avoid foreign entanglements.
Which Correct.
Means especially Europe's foreign entanglements. And to avoid them, stay away, like Ron Paul said, let them resolve it, and then we won't get involved. And suddenly we had to change, because the goal was to create a United Nations, first of all, a League of Nations, which failed, to then plan a second world war to give us the United Nations.
Isn't the League of Nations just the same, or actually backwards, isn't the United Nations just the same as the League of Nations with a different name?
Well, it could be. I'm not a great student of the League of Nations. All I know is that the treaty was signed at the end of World War I, at the Treaty of Versailles.
Yes.
The American government signed the treaty to create the League of Nations, and the Woodrow Wilson came back to the United States, and the Senate refused to ratify the treaty. And Woodrow Wilson went on a nationwide speaking tour begging the American people to create this, to put pressure on the Senate to approve it. And I believe the reason was because Woodrow Wilson has been promised the government of the world that they were going to create with the League of Nations. And I also believe Franklin Roosevelt was promised the same thing in about 1932 or 33, that if we got the League of Nations, or the United Nations after World War II, he would become the head of it. And that was an awful big plum for a man to achieve to.
Have you confronted any government official with this copy of the newspaper?
No, I wouldn't even know. I don't have a chance. I've got other issues with my congressmen and senators, but I understand there it is. By the way, and I want your people to know, I didn't do it with a computer and a modem. I did that strictly. In fact, I still got the envelope from the library, Hilo, Hawaii. I called the library, asked them if they had the paper. Would they make me a photocopy of the top? And they sent it to me. Anyone can do that to verify that this article is real.
Right. And I wanted to preface the show with that, which, like I said, jumped at me when I went to your website. But, Ralph, just what is it that you have found that you wish to bring to the attention of our listeners?
Well, in a very short summary form, Mel, there is a conspiracy at work in the United States and the world. In fact, Bill Clinton told us about it on the night of July the 16th, 1992, on national television. He confirmed that there was an international conspiracy already at work, not only in the United States, but in the world, and that they already controlled the world. It wasn't over yet. They controlled it, and they hadn't gotten their world government that many people believe they want.
And I believe you said President Bill Clinton, I believe that he had no aversion to it. In other words, his mentor, Carol Quigley, said that, and he's not opposed to the conspiracy.
Here's the way that Bill Clinton did this, and I'll make it as brief as I can. Bill Clinton, as a child, wanted to become president. He decided that he, for some reason, or at least get into politics. And he met Senator William Fulbright in Arkansas. That's where Clinton was from. And William Fulbright, I believe, encouraged him to go to college at Georgetown University, where he would be taught by Dr. Carol Quigley. And Dr. Quigley, he did go to Georgetown University, and there Clinton was taught for 4 years by Dr. Carol Quigley. Halfway between his 4 years there, in 1966, Dr. Quigley published his book entitled Tragedy and Hope. And that book details very carefully, by naming names and details, that there is an international conspiracy. It's very real. It controls both parties equally. It controls communism, and it also financed World War to both sides. Hitler's war machine was built not in totally, but almost totally by American and European businessmen with a certain outcome of a World War II.
Almost like Michael Rupert would say, instead of Republicans and Democrats, we have the Gambinos on one side and the Genoveses on the other side.
Well, you understand, Bill Clinton told us this on live national television. And yet you can ask any Democrat you want, does he know about Dr. Carroll Quigley? And they say no. But Bill Clinton said it with his own mouth, that Dr. Quigley got him into politics. Well, with the assistance of John Kennedy. He met John Kennedy in the summer of 1963 at a thing called Boys Nation. And there's been a picture released of Bill Clinton as a young man, 16 years old approximately, shaking the hand of John Kennedy. Now, it had to be the summer because, as you know, Kennedy was assassinated in later that year in November in Dallas, Texas. So here's a picture of Clinton and Kennedy, and that's what he said, that two people got him into politics. One was John Kennedy, and one was Dr. Carroll Quigley. But really, the one who promoted it was, I believe, Senator William Fulbright. He urged him to go to Georgetown, and after Georgetown, to try to secure a scholarship at Oxford, what they call a Rhodes Scholarship.
Rhodes Scholar, yes.
And he did. He got the arrangement. He went there for 2 years, and left there in 1970, and came back to the United States. So now, what did he learn as a Rhodes Scholarship? He learned that this conspiracy was indeed international, and that he was urged to support it, and the Rhodes Scholarship Group was the one that created the Council on Foreign Relations in 1920 to bring about a world government in the United Nations and planned World War II. So Clinton knows this, and he said it on national television. People call me a conspiracy theorist. I'm not. I'm a conspiracy realist, just like Bill Clinton is.
And by the way, we changed one of our mottos is conspiracies, but we now call our show parapolitical research. That's a more appropriate term. And this is what Clinton actually said, quote, there does exist an international Anglophile, that means basically English, network, which operates in the way the radical right believes the communists and act. In fact, this network has no aversion to cooperating with the communists and frequently does so. I have no aversion to it, unquote.
That's exactly what Bill Clinton learned, and he because he believed that and learned about it, he was rewarded with the Rhodes Scholarship and ultimately with the presidency of the United States.
By the way, Rhodes, that's obviously Cecil Rhodes. Wasn't there a country in Africa called Rhodesia because of him?
Yes. Apparently Rhodes, in furtherance of his goals to create a world government, actually an English world government, primarily English, they went to South Africa and literally forced a war amongst the Dutch to get control of the gold mines and the diamond mines, and it was called the Boer War. So
yes,
young British soldiers can die as long as we get control of the gold mines. That's okay. I'm sure the British, the parents of the young man who died in that war, they understood that was what it was all about, was giving Cecil Rhodes the diamond mines and gold mines, taking it away from the Dutch. And that's fine. People understand. That's what wars are fought for, is to get people wealthy. And Rhodes became a multimillionaire, and the nation of Rhodesia, R-H-O-D-E-S-I-A, was named after Cecil Rhodes. Now, how many people have nations named after them? Not too many that I know of.
Now, let's go now back to the Constitution. James Madison, later to become president, is called the father of the Constitution. Didn't he say that the powers of the Constitution are few and defined?
Absolutely. That statement is in the book called The Federalist Papers. He was trying to point out that the powers of the federal government are limited, but we need to talk because they're not.
Please explain. Elaborate on this.
Okay, I'll do it as briefly as I can. And I hope by now your listeners will have gotten out a copy of the Declaration and the Constitution, because we're going to read some just things as briefly as we can. Let's go to the second paragraph of the Declaration of Independence. Down the bottom, it reads, the history of the present king of the Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. Now, notice that we have been taught that we fought the revolution because of taxation without representation. Yet there's not one mention of that in our Declaration. Why? The gross taxes of England have been estimated to be less than 1% of our gross national product in those days. We're now paying 50% without representation, and there's no tax revolt. So that was not the issue. We just learned what it was. Creating a tyranny. Now, the word tyranny has been defined for 6,000 years as total power in the hands of the government. Primarily in the old days, it used to be kings. So in a monarchy. But of course, it applies to any tyrant who takes over government, even if it's the majority. Now, our founding fathers said, then the next sentence says, to prove this, let facts be presented or submitted to a candid world. And we're going to go down to about the 22nd of these. So King George was suspending our own legislatures. Now, a tyrant who works through a government uses government to pass laws. It says, we're going to do this legal. We're going to have a law passed eliminating your rights, let's say. But as long as it's legal, it's legal. So King George was suspending our legislatures, meaning this Georgia couldn't have their own legislature, and declared themselves invested with power to legislate for us in all cases whatsoever. There is no limit to that power. That's the very tyranny he was describing. Tyranny is total government. The power to legislate in all cases whatsoever is total tyranny. It's total power. There's no limit, no Magna Carta, no Constitution, no Bill of Rights, nothing. He was creating a powerful, tyrannical government in the United States. When there's whatever the king says, pass a law, it's law. No argument, no rights, no freedoms, nothing. Now, we're going to go 11 years later to the Constitution, and we're going to read what the Founding Fathers did. They're creating a legislature in Article 1, Section 8. Legislative Department. And then we go to Section 8, and it says, Congress shall have the power, and then they list them. Now, there's only 18 listed. So in other words, they are few and defined, as Madison said. So I'm going to briefly do this, just in summary form. Congress shall have the power to collect taxes, borrow money, regulate commerce, coin money, punish counterfeiting, establish post offices, punish piracies, declare war, raise an army, etc. And then we read the 17th one. Congress shall have the power to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever. Wait. Is that a repeat of the very same words we just read in the Declaration? Yes, it is. Now, wait a minute. In 1776, we just said, our founding father said, the power to legislate in all cases whatsoever is tyranny. Didn't we? Isn't that what it
said? Yes, we did.
Yes or no? Of course, that's what we just read. King George was suspending our legislatures and creating his own with the power to legislate in all cases whatsoever. And we called that tyranny in 1776. But 11 years later, we called it giving Congress power. Why? I don't understand. Now, let's ask this, let's come back and obliquely get back to this. Let's finish that thought. To exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district, meaning the 10-mile square Washington, D.C., which shall become the seat of government of the United States. Now, wait. I thought we were the United States. No, only Washington, D.C. is the United States. We live in a country called the United States of America.
So they're two separate entities?
Exactly correct. Now notice, the Social Security laws, or whatever they are, that gives us our Social Security benefits, they don't have the same thing in Washington, D.C. The senators have a different program. Why? Aren't they citizens like all the rest of us? Why? Because they're a separate government. They were given absolute dictatorial, tyrannical power in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. And they know it. Now, let's go back to this define, few and define, by going to the 10th Amendment. let's go to the 10th Amendment and we'll read the following. I'm flipping pages in my own book here, and I'm urging your listeners to do so as well. Find the 10th Amendment and let's read together. The powers not delegated, delegated means they're listed someplace. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states, respectively, or to the people. Now, what does that mean? It means that if we didn't delegate it, Congress doesn't have it. Now, I read briefly the 17 others of the 18 powers of Congress. Where did I read the Congress should have the power to fund stem cell research? How would our founding fathers have envisioned that? I didn't hear anything about stem cell research. How about the power to tax us to go to the moon? How could our founding fathers have delegated that?
Well, but
no power, no knowledge of such a thing.
Let me interject for one moment. I think also times change, and don't you think that sometimes, and I'm just playing devil's advocate, don't you think that sometimes you have to evolve to adapt to the current situations?
Let's go back. George Washington said that if you're going to want Congress to have the power to fund stem cell research, amend the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
We had 10 originally, now we're up to 26. We've added 16 more. In other words, if you want to have this power, delegate it. Those powers not delegated, that means they've got to be listed. And Madison said they're few and defined. But Madison's the one who wrote Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. He lied to us. Because Congress has the power to do whatever it jolly well wants. And that's the government running America. Do you think they don't know this in Congress? I think they do. The problem is the American people don't know this. We don't study the Constitution. I went all the way through the University of Arizona and never had it even mentioned once. Now, I didn't major in political science, but I took classes in political science, took classes in civics in high school. They never taught us the Constitution. Why? Because they were afraid we might find Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. They have the power to do whatever they included, America. Hear this. They've already eliminated. Are you ready for this, Mel? Do you want to hear this or not?
Go ahead.
They've already eliminated the Constitution. It's gone. It's blotto. It's dead. It's zero. It's nil. It's null. It's void. How do I know that? The Supreme Court decision called the Erie Railroad versus Tompkins case of 1938. Supreme Court decided there is no common law in the United States means there ain't no Constitution. I'll tell you how I know that. I'll give you proof of it. Way back in the early 70s, way before we knew there was no Constitution, I met a chiropractor in Portland, Oregon, who was stopped paying income taxes because he said, I'm a Mormon. The Mormon church has its own program, and I'm a Mormon and an elder in the church, and if I get sick or need it, the church will take care of me. They'll give me benefits. I've got a family with 5 kids. They'll take care of me, so I don't need Social Security. So he stopped paying. And he went to court, and he was charged by the IRS with failure to file. So he went to the court. And by the way, I saw this myself with my own eyes. I read a transcript of his case, and he told me this personally. He said that when he went to court, he said to the judge, "Your Honor, I'm going to use the Constitution of the United States as my defense." And the judge banged the gavel down, dismissed the jury, and said to the doctor, "Please do not mention the Constitution in my courtroom." Wait. You don't seem to understand, Judge. The Supreme Court, the Constitution is the supreme law of the land.
Yes.
And he said, don't mention it. But, Your Honor, it's my sole defense. Don't mention it, Doctor. So the judge brought the jury back in. A few minutes later, I won't mention his name. He's probably gone now, but it's just the point. He said, the doctor said, "By the way, Your Honor, I want to read Article 2 of the Constitution." And the gavel went down again, and the judge admonished the doctor, "You are not to mention the Constitution in my courtroom at all." Now, remember, the oath of the judge was to take to support, defend, and protect the Constitution of the United States, but not, you can't use it in his courtroom. Why? Why? Wait a minute. If it's the supreme law of the land, I don't care what laws Congress passed, they're not, they're inviolate. They're violent, right? They're notwithstanding. That's what I'm looking for. They don't mean anything. Congress has no power to pass it, and upon passing, it's still null and void.
So, Ralph, if our judiciary dismisses the Constitution as a piece of disposable paper, to, for lack of a more derogatory word that I hate to use, but that's the way the Constitution has been treated lately. If our own judges dismiss our Constitution, what protection do we have as citizens?
We don't have any. We are living under a thing called the Uniform Commercial Code.
Yes, UCC.
You want proof of that? I'll give you another example. A friend of mine made an illegal right-hand turn in a small city north of Tucson. It's a small farming community. Probably don't even have a stoplight. But I guess it must have had at least a stop sign, because my friend made an illegal right-hand turn. Now, he didn't run over anybody, didn't run down to some pedestrians in the crosswalk, or he didn't hit a bus or knock over some nuns who were walking, or a lady with her dog, or knock over a fence or a telephone pole. He just made an illegal right-hand turn. So the policeman stopped him and said, you are in violation of ARS 1497 and whatever it is, and here's a ticket, and you have three choices. You can pay it right now, put the money in there, drop it in the mailbox. You can go home to Tucson where you live, and you can fill out the papers and send a check back, or you can go see the judge. And he says, I want to see the judge. So he went to the judge and sat in the courtroom until the judge finally said, in the matter of, I want to make up his name. His first name is Real Maury, but I'll use his make-up last name. In the matter of the city of Eloy, Arizona, versus Maury Jones, are you in the court? Yes, sir, I am here. I'm right here, sir. He said, well, how do you plead in this matter of making an illegal right-hand turn? He says, well, Your Honor, before I plead, I'd like to know, ask a question. And by the way, he's been trained, and I'll explain why in a minute. He said, mm-hmm. Yes, what's your question, Mr. Jones? Well, Your Honor, I don't understand what type of court I am in. Well, I don't understand. This is clearly the traffic court of the city of Eloy, Arizona, a legal corporation mm-hmm. created by the state and charter. So we're a legal court. I understand that, Your Honor, but you know, I'm going to give the whole sentence and then come back. What he was going to say was, but Your Honor, I don't understand what type of court this is. Is this a common law court, a court of equity law, or a court of admiralty law? Those are the only three types of courts mentioned in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. As soon as he said, started out with the common law. That's all he could get out of his mouth. Is this a court of common law? And the judge, according to my friend, who's a personal friend, I've known him for 20 years, he said the judge banged the gavel down angrily and shouted at him, case dismissed. Do not come back into my court, Mr. Jones.
Why do you think that happened?
Now, let's go back over this. There's no question he made the illegal right-hand turn. There's a legally approved court expert called a policeman who is the eyewitness to the crime. He saw it happen. So it's his word against Maury, and Maury's that guy from southern Arizona called Tucson. Why should we believe him? We can trust the policeman. So the guy did it. He made the illegal right-hand turn. What defense do you have? Now, notice the judge didn't want to hear the case about whether he did or did not make the illegal right-hand turn.
He wanted to avoid it.
He dismissed the entire court for that case and said, don't you ever come back to my court. Now, why?
Why?
Because he knows there is no common law court, and the Constitution is the common law. Now, let's go back to the common law. What is it? It's the old English style. In fact, it goes back to the Old Testament. The only crime is when you injure somebody or their property. So going back to my friend Maury, did he run over some pedestrians? No. Did he knock over a sign? No. Did he run into a school bus? No. Did he rip apart the street by, something dragging the back of his car? No. He made an illegal right-hand turn. No damages. So who's the injured party? There is none. Who did he injure? The city of Eloy? How did he do that? Okay, then if he did injure the city, bring someone here who can testify that they were injured by my making this illegal right-hand turn, and there's no such case.
But Ralph, just to play devil's advocate here, I understand that nobody was hurt, but don't they have a law that says you cannot execute an illegal right-hand turn? And if that's the case, how do they enforce that law?
Because there is no law requiring us to get a driver's license in Arizona. I don't know about other states. And the way you can prove that, if you live in Arizona or anywhere else, when you go to get your license, look for that little booklet. Now, here in Arizona, forgive me, I can only speak about Arizona. They've had a little booklet that you pick up. Say you're from New Jersey and you're moving to Arizona. Here's the laws in Arizona that you are going to get a license for. You have to have one within 6 months or whatever it is. Okay, so you have to have a license. So they tell you got to have a license. Now, the book that's maybe 50 pages long tells you about right turns, left turns, construction zones, school zones, right turns, left turns, signs, detours, whatever it is, all detailed out there. But there's not one mention of a law. Why? There's no law. See, under the Uniform Commercial Code, it's all about contract. And no one can force you into a contract. You've got to volunteer. If you force me into a contract, I can have the courts declare it null and void.
So what happens if I'm driving in Arizona and I don't have my license? I just drive without a license. What's the repercussion
there? Once you get one and don't have one, then you've already agreed that you are voluntarily accepting the rules, regulations, statutes, whatever it is that regulate driving in Arizona. But under
so
the
if you never
law,
did...
Okay, what's that? Go ahead.
If you never did, if you came from another state, another sovereign state here, and you drive, your license from New Jersey expires, and you're driving and you're exceeding the speed limit and you're stopped by a policeman, what happens?
Well, you tell him, you say to the policeman, please go ahead and give me your ticket, and then I'm going to ask you as a policeman, to bring the injured party into the court under the common law. There is no common law. Now, the policeman probably doesn't know. And that's what my friend was trying to do. He was trying to say to the judge, okay, Your Honor, if this is a common law court, a common law requires that there be an injured party. Someone was either injured physically by my making this legal right-hand turn, or I damaged someone's property, and they're seeking restitution. So let's bring the injured party in. And who's injured? The city of Eloy? He didn't run over a policeman. He didn't knock over a kid in a sidewalk, or a kid on a bicycle, or a lady walking her dog. He made an illegal right-hand turn. But see, when you get a license, you're voluntarily accepting the jurisdiction of every law they want to pass. This is why they call driving a privilege. It used to be
the same
right.
thing.
Right.
Isn't the same thing for Social Security?
Yes.
You don't have to have one?
Nope. I'll tell you how I know that. Try to find the law. Please, if you want. I'll use the income tax law. I know specifically. There's a group of people who've gotten together and pledged $100,000 if you can find the income tax law.
Yes.
Come on, wait a minute, America. There was a guy, Aaron Russo, did a movie. He was a producer of movies in Hollywood. And he did a movie. I've forgotten the name of it. But in there, he talked to people about the law. And he made the statement, and a lady heard him.
By the way, I don't mean to interrupt you, Ralph, but it's called America from Freedom to Fascism.
Yes. Okay, that's it. Thank you. So he interviewed a lady that worked for the IRS. She was a collection agent. She had a gun and a car, and she was told out to go out and get taxes from the people who didn't file or didn't file properly. So she heard this program one day, someone else say this. She says, well, wait a minute. I work for the IRS, and I've never thought about the law. So she tried, said, I can make $100,000. Guys, that's wonderful. Because if there's a law, that I should be able to find it because I work for them. She couldn't find the law. Wait a minute, what law? Why is there no law? Because we're not living under compulsion. We're living under freedom. You are free not to get a license or to get a Social Security card. But we think we have to. Oh, do we? Show me the law.
But what happens, Ralph, when somebody goes to apply for a job? They need a Social Security card, don't they?
Nope. There's a form you can use from the Social Security Administration, I don't know what the number of it is, that tells your employer that you don't have a card, and that they are not eligible, not the right word, they're not allowed, to say it that way, to withdraw taxes from your income. and the employer signs it and sends it in to the IRS and the Social Security Administration, and they have to accept it. Huh? I've seen the form.
So the employer does not have to take Social Security taxes and federal taxes from the employees? Is that what you're saying?
As long as the man does not have a card. Once he has a card, he's agreed to pay taxes. You volunteer under the 14th Amendment to and the 13th Amendment, we'll discuss that if you wish. You volunteer because we're living under the law of contract. So we have been told, we thought, we've been told, I don't remember how I was told. I was told, my mother had a friend, my father and my mother had a friend who was a casting director for a movie called Oklahoma back in the late 50s here in Arizona. And so I was told I could be an extra. I said, well, I'll get a chance to make a movie. So I said, I was like 15 or 16, and I was told I had to have a Social Security card to do that. No, I didn't know, so I said, okay, I'll go get one, and I got one, and then I applied for a job as an extra. But wait a minute, I didn't look for the law, because there is no law. I can't find it. Please, show me the law.
You're saying volunteer. I had our daughter two years ago. She was born in the hospital. Hours after she was born, I had people already asking me to fill out the Social Security card information. So my daughter theoretically did not volunteer.
That's correct. By the way, please understand, I took courses in business administration at the University of Arizona. I took a class called business law, which was just basically the law of contract and what we have to do and how you get people to sign and terms, et cetera. And we were taught there's only two ways out of a contract. Both parties can be agree to eliminate the contract, void it, or if one party can prove force or fraud. Now, children are not allowed to contract for major things, only necessities. In other words, let's just make it a silly story that parents are killed in a cyclone or a tornado, and little Junior wanders into a grocery store and says, I'm hungry. And the grocer says, okay, buy some. He says, well, I can't. I don't have any money. So he says, okay, let's sign a contract, and I'll give you the money or loan it to you. And then later on, the young man says, well, wait a minute, I'm a minor. I can't contract. And he said, oh, yes, you can. You contracted for food. Now, if he went in to buy a Cadillac, that's not a necessity. So this is how they get young people to believe they have to have a contract. I was, I think, 15 or 16, but I'll go back to your case about the child. When I was in Arkansas speaking at a conference, a young couple came up to me, and the husband and wife together, and they said, we got to tell you a story. I said, go ahead. He said, we were in a hospital. We brought the wife came in to have the baby. The baby was delivered normally, naturally, and we're there, I don't know, 2 days or whatever it was. And so we're ready to take our baby home. The doctors released her. And so we went to go get our baby, and we were told we couldn't get our baby without a Social Security card.
Huh.
And she said, oh, yes, we can. No, 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 you don't seem to understand. We're required to get you, have you, you can't leave without it. He said, well, please bring the administrator down here. So they went to the, they waited, and they got the hospital administrator came down. He said, what's the problem? Well, the nurse says, well, this couple won't give their child a Social Security number. And he said, well, we're required to do that. And he said, the young man says, no, we're not. Please show me the law that requires us to do that. And this judge, the administrator said, no, no, it's just our policy. I said, I don't care what about your policy. If you hold that baby after we ask to take it away, we will charge you with kidnapping. And the hospital administrator said, thank you very much for coming in and have a nice day.
Isn't it plausible to say that the powers that be are using hospitals for this to convince people that they have to have a Social Security card, and also vaccines? I remember the number of vaccines that we had to have our daughter go through in just a matter of 24 hours.
Yes, I know. Now, that's another issue, vaccines. I am of the opinion not to take one ever. Of course, I went through the traditional, although when I went to school, there was no, that I remember, no vaccinations at all. But the issue is this. Let's just go back. Please understand, under the 13th and 14th Amendments, we have to volunteer. I have a letter from the Social Security Administration issued some time ago by the director who says the Social Security benefits, the law, the requirements for a number are voluntary. He admits it. Now, Aaron Russo was able to talk to a former head of the IRS who had retired and gone to work for a law firm. And
yes, I saw that.
Remember that?
Yes.
And what did the man say about the law? He couldn't find it.
He couldn't find it.
Yeah. He didn't know about the law. Yeah. Now, there's one more case in that Aaron Russo movie. He interviewed a lady who was a juror. And the case was very simple. The man had not filed. And so the judge, the man produced a copy of a video that he made himself while he was being interviewed by two IRS agents in one of their offices. And they were sitting on one side of a table. He was on the other. And at the end of the table, he put a camera and was recording the whole thing in a microphone. So he kept saying to them, please, I'll be happy to pay the tax if you can show me the law. And they refused to do it. Not that they refused. They just didn't answer his question. He kept saying, please, I'm here. If there's a law that requires me to pay taxes, please understand, I will pay the law, you know, take the taxes. But show me the law. No, I didn't do it. So finally, he used that in court as evidence.
Ralph, if the person is there with two IRS agents, and usually they have guns sometimes, if there's no law and they're demanding payment, isn't that called coercion?
Yes. Now here's the problem. When you appeal a Social Security or income tax conclusion, you go through an IRS or Social Security Administration court. Well, I want to get in front of the federal judge. No. We have our own internal administration. Now, are they going to let you out or not? I don't think so. Please understand, I can show you how it came about in the 13th and 14th Amendments if you want to spend a few minutes.
Go ahead.
Okay. Get your copy of the Constitution. Let's go to the 13th Amendment. 13th Amendment reads, neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime, shall exist within the United States. So slavery or involuntary servitude. Slavery is the forcing of one individual to work for another. Involuntary servitude, I guess in those old days where someone would come from Europe and they were forced into a contract with a shoemaker or something. Mm-hmm. So they're saying that the words to me are interchangeable. So slavery shall not exist in the United States, or involuntary servitude. But notice, voluntary servitude is permitted. You can volunteer anytime you want to. Anytime you want to volunteer to be a slave, you're free to do so. See, we can volunteer to pay an income tax till they take it all away from us anytime we want to. That's provision. That's what the 13th Amendment's about. That's
so you volunteered. Said. You volunteer yourself to obtain your Social Security card, or your parents volunteered for you if that's legal.
Correct.
What happens later when you find out that there's no law? How can you relinquish from that? Can you?
Let's finish. Let's go to the 14th, and I'll try to answer your question.
Okay.
So in other words, voluntary servitude is permitted. You can volunteer anytime you want to become a serf or a slave. You're free to do so. That's what it said. Now, the 14th Amendment says all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. That was passed in 1867. Now, wait a minute. What were we before the 14th Amendment? We were never called citizens of the United States because the United States is only Washington, D.C. We were citizens of the state of Georgia, wherein we resided, or Arizona, where you were born. Now, if you move to California, you're a resident of the state of California, a citizen of California, able to vote in California elections, even though you weren't born there. So now, notice the word persons. We were called the people of the United States of America, joined together to write the Constitution. The people. People live by unalienable rights. What's an unalienable right? You can't give it up. You can give it up, I'm sorry, but nobody can take it. It came from our Creator. All men were endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. What does that mean? We were given the right to life. No man has the right to take our life. Only the Creator can take our life. Now, we certainly are people who do this all the time. Murder is very common in America and in other nations as well. and when they do, they're punished. You violated a man's unalienable right. Now, we used to live by unalienable rights, but persons live by privilege. Now, what does the word right mean? A right is permission to act morally without permission. The fact that you are American, you have the right. You don't have to ask government to exist. You have the unalienable God-given right to live. Now, the government comes in and says, no, 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 we don't live by rights anymore. We live by privileges. Privileges are granted by the state, and of course, they can be taken away by the state. In other words, if my friend Maury decided to fight this and refused to pay the fee, the fine, if he was found guilty, he goes to jail. He had the unalienable right to travel until he became a person under the 14th Amendment. Now, it does say this. You can either be born in the United States or naturalized. Now, I'm not born in Washington, D.C. I was born in Arizona. I've got proof of that. I have a birth certificate, and my parents certified. It's in the Bible, family Bible, and they certified, and everybody accepted me as being the son of my parents. I got a birth certificate. Now, it says that I can become a naturalized citizen of the United States. Now, what does that mean? I'll use the Schwarzenegger, our governor of California. He's a naturalized citizen. He was not born in the United States. He was born in Austria. So I gather that someplace in Austria, there's a limit. I would say maybe 10 can come into America every year. I don't know. But so Schwarzenegger went through the process of naturalization. He didn't come here illegally. He didn't swim the Atlantic Ocean to get here. He didn't crawl aboard. You know, he came in naturally, normally. And after 5 years of waiting and doing whatever it is, he can become a naturalized citizen, which means he's equal to a born citizen. I'm born here. He's not. He's a natural citizen, but he has the same rights that I do. But he's a naturalized citizen of the United States, which means he's subject to the jurisdiction of an all-powerful, tyrannical government that has the power to legislate in all cases whatsoever. And let me bring this a little bit closer to home. I live in Tucson, Arizona, across the border from Mexico. And when I was in college, I don't know why this stuck in my memory, but here's the story. My parents and I and my brother and my grandmother went across the border. My parents are gone, so is my grandmother, so I'm not doing any harm now. So we drove across the border, parked in Nogales, which is the border city in Mexico, yes. And then got back in the car after we finished and drove back. And as we were driving up there, there's a 5 or 6 car wait. So my mother says to my grandmother, Mom, in a few minutes, they're going to ask you, she's from New Jersey visiting. So he said, mine's going to ask you, where were you born? Please don't say Poland, because she was a naturalized citizen. Because you don't have your papers, and they're going to think you're illegal, and they can't get in here, you don't have any papers, they'll detain you, and you know, whatever. So just say you were born in New York. So the man opened it when my father opened the window, down went the window. Where were you born? My grandmother says, New Jersey. So she was allowed to come back in the United States. Now when you go across the same border, you're asked, are you a citizen of the United States? Right? Are you subject to the jurisdiction of the all-powerful, all-tyrannical government called the United States? Notice, if you're a naturalized citizen, you're a dual citizenship. You're a citizen of the United States and in the state in which you reside. But prior to this 14th Amendment, we were never called citizens of the United States unless we were born in Washington, D.C. So now...
Explain again. I'm a little confused. Explain the difference between United States and United States of America. I'm not too clear.
Only Washington, D.C. is the United States. I can give you, in fact, you can get confirm this on your IRS form or call the IRS or read the treaty signed by the United States.
Mm-hmm.
The United States is only Washington, D.C. That's all. The states are called the United States of America. By the way, in the Declaration of Independence, the word United is not capitalized because they're saying the states. Now, when you say these states, referring to 13 specific states, you capitalize the S in states. So we were called Americans. the states of America united together to form the federal government. So it was called the small U, United States of America. They were states united together to form the union called America. We're all Americans, including, but the people in Washington, D.C. are not called Americans. They're citizens of the United States, born there. It's a separate legal government.
And so what's the difference? What's the difference between somebody who's born in Washington, D.C. and somebody who's born in Virginia?
Well, if you're born in Washington, D.C., you're subject to Congress having total power over your life. I'll give you two proofs. Now, these are only from newspaper articles. I don't know. I just read the newspaper. There was a person arrested for carrying a gun in Washington, D.C. Now, wait a minute. Wait. What's wrong with that? The Second Amendment says we have the right to keep and bear arms. No, Congress has allowed the District of Corruption, I call it, the D.C., have allowed them to made a law that says you can't carry a gun in on your side in a holster. Now, here in Arizona, I go to meetings all the time with people who are carrying guns. We don't have any such restriction. But in Washington, D.C., now, wait a minute, the Second Amendment says we all have the right to carry, keep, and bear arms. No, we don't if you're a citizen of Washington, D.C. Secondly, they have a curfew. Curfew? Where did they get that right? Congress has the right.
Curfew, as in martial law, almost?
Yes. You can't be out after 8 o'clock or 10 o'clock, whatever it is.
Huh.
Now, wait a minute, where did they get that power? That's not in the Constitution. They don't have to. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 gives total power to Congress in Washington, D.C. Now, they've allowed them to have a city charter and a mayor. But if the mayor starts acting up, he can be removed by Congress. The government of Washington, D.C. is completely dependent upon Congress under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. And they were given total, unlimited, despotic, tyrannical power. Now, they don't have that power over the states, but we have become a naturalized citizen under the 14th Amendment. How did we do that? It just said you can become a naturalized citizen or be born there, and then if you are, you are a citizen of the United States. Now, when I cross the border back into Arizona, I tell the man I was born in Arizona. If he wants, I'll produce a birth certificate to get back in, which means I'm a citizen of the states of America, of the state in which I was born, Arizona. Now, if I was coming across in California, I'm a citizen of the state of California. See?
But bear in mind that what we have on the borders are not state officers. They're federal officers.
Because, as I'm trying to get you to understand, once I got a Social Security card, I voluntarily became subject to the jurisdiction of the government of the United States and became a U.S. citizen. Read your income tax form. Who must pay income taxes? Citizens of the United States.
So you didn't answer my question. For the persons who are listening who are saying, okay, and how do I revoke that? If I volunteered to get a Social Security card, how can I undo that? Is that possible?
Okay, let me ask you this. Going back to what I learned, all I can tell you, I'm not an attorney. All I can tell you is what I learned in my business law class.
And by the way, folks, we're not trying to break the law here. We're just trying to understand the law. So anybody who's misinterpreting what we're trying to say, we're not trying to circumvent what's been established. Go ahead, Ralph.
Now, but once you volunteer, you become subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. In other words, they say, we can only give this benefit to citizens of the United States. Well, I'm not born there, but I can become naturalized. It says all persons born or naturalized in the United States. Now, which means that under the 14th Amendment, the 13th Amendment, I'm free to volunteer to become a serf, a slave. It's permitted. That's what the 13th Amendment does. It permits voluntary servitude. So now they got to get us to volunteer. In legal terms, those of you who are legal attorneys know the phrase color of law. Judges use it, but they don't use it commonly. But color of law means it looks like a law, sounds like a law, but it's not. Congress, under the Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, has the power to administer law where there is no law. It looks like a law, sounds like a law, and you better obey it. But it's not law. It's called color of law. Do you understand? Let me give you one more example. You might, and I'm sure maybe you've heard this about Philip Berg, the attorneys trying to get the Supreme Court to rule on whether or not Obama was natural born, and if he's not natural born under the Constitution, he cannot be president.
Yes, yes.
And the evidence is abundant that he was born in Kenya. Therefore, he's not natural born. He wasn't born in the United States or the United States of America. He was born in Kenya. His own grandmother has certified that. His father's two brothers have certified he was born in Kenya. So Philip Berg is trying to get the Supreme Court to determine for require that Obama present a birth certificate from Hawaii, which would certify, you know, that he was born in the United States. And he doesn't have that. He doesn't have, well, he says he's got a certificate of live birth, which is a piece of paper that said, yes, this man brought this baby, a lady, a mother, wife, or father, brought the baby and certified that it was born naturally, and it's called a live certificate of live birth. You cannot use a certificate, I'm told, to get a passport because they want
it. Did you see in the last couple of days, in the last few days, a soldier who was going to be deployed to Afghanistan and refused to do so through his attorney because he's saying, because our president was not born in the United States, I do not take it as law for me to be deployed to Afghanistan. Have you followed that?
Because he's not, his commander-in-chief is not eligible to require him to go. He's not commander-in-chief. He's, to be president, you've got to be a natural-born citizen, and he's not. Mm-hmm. But now, let me finish. I got in on a talk show way back before the election and asked, talked to Mr. Berg as a guest. I said, Mr. Berg, I want to commend you. I think you're right, but here's the point. You're not going to get an answer. He said, why? Because the Supreme Court has ruled in the Erie Railroad versus Tompkins case in 1938, there is no Constitution. He said, what? I said, trust me, Mr. Berg, please call me. Call me off the air and let's talk. I'll prove it. I'll give you the evidence. Give me the time to explain. I can't do it over the talk show. I'll call you. He never did. Now, just a matter of, say, a month ago, 5 months after the inauguration of Obama, I'm still telling him on another talk show, Mr. Berg, you're not going to get an answer. And you haven't gotten one, and you won't get one. Because the Supreme Court cannot admit the Constitution is null and void.
For if they do, what would happen if they did?
We ain't got no president.
Mm-hmm.
And the Democratic Party could be held liable for not checking that out before they offered him as a candidate.
But Ralph, we have to take our one and only break. But I want you to please answer the question again. For those who are wondering, if they volunteered for, what you're saying is, correct me if I'm wrong, slavery was abolished. However, voluntary servitude is permitted.
That's correct.
How? But you applying for a Social Security card, which makes you a citizen of the United States. Am I following you right?
Correct.
So, if you relinquish from that number, what happens? And is that possible?
No, because the only way out of a contract, there's only two ways. One, proving force or fraud, and the second way is getting both parties to agree. You want out of the contract, but I can assure you the Socialist Security Administration does not want you out. So, they're going to say, you signed it, it's a contract, you got to comply. That's what courts are for.
On the way back from the break, we have so much to talk about. But I have heard that after the Great Depression of the 30s, the Federal Reserve came to the government and said, how are you going to pay us back? And that's when Social Security came about later in order to collateralize people. And I think the number today is about $2 million, but somebody's valued. Do you follow that?
Yeah, I've heard this argument, and I don't get into it because it's something we can't prove yet, and I don't get into it. I'm saying this. The only way you can get out of your Social Security Administration card is you've got to prove force or fraud, and I'm saying you're going to go to a federal court and try to defeat that? I don't think so. That's my point. I don't know anyone that's beat it.
So that's why hospitals are accessory to this.
Well, I won't call them that. That's a legal term. I don't know. I just say this. I can give you the example. Think about it. This young man could charge them with kidnapping. They're keeping a child without permission. They're not babysitting that child. I want my baby. I'm going to take my baby. My baby's free to go. The doctor has released my baby. It's healthy. No requirements to keep it here for future shots or surgery or anything. I want my baby. No, you got to have a card. No, I'll charge you with kidnapping. And the hotel administrator, the hospital administrator said, goodbye. Thank you for coming.
Folks, if you haven't opened your eyes, I hope that in the last hour you have, and wait until you hear what's left of the program. We're going to be coming to part two, but we have to take a break. We're here with Ralph Epperson. We're going to be talking about the Kennedy assassination, Vietnam, the fascist oligarchy that we're going through, and so much more, and the New World Order. So, Ralph, how do we get in touch with your work?
You're very kind. Thank you, Mel. People can go to www.ralph-epperson.com. R-A-L-P-H-Epperson, E-P-P-E-R-S-O-N. E-P-P-E-R-S-O-N.com. It's a free go there. You can watch this. If you want to watch a Google video, you have access to the Google video. Go there and watch America's Secret Destiny. All of this is covered, detailed in great detail. You can watch it. I'll walk you through it with the documentation, the word-for-word transcript of the words out of the Declaration of the Constitution. America's Secret Destiny, free. You can watch it on Google Video.
And folks, there's so much more left on the show. This is Mel Fabregas, and you're listening to The Veritas Show. Don't go anywhere. Thank you very much for listening. We are going to talk more with Ralph Epperson in our members section. We still have not one, but two more hours to go. Ralph was just warming up. Wait until you hear what else he has to say. You cannot miss it. Head on over to our website, veritasshow.com, click on subscribe, and join us in the members area to tune in to the next two uninterrupted full hours of Ralph Epperson's revelations, The Unseen Hand, The New World Order, and much more. No wonder the mainstream media and even other shows don't want Ralph to talk. But not here. We are uncensored and unscripted. Let's take a short break, listen to some music, and we'll be right back with Ralph Epperson.
This is Catherine Austin Fitz, and you're listening to The Veritas Show.